Now, I'm delighted to say that I am joined on the line by Pádraic Mannion. He's Secretary of PANA, which stands for the Peace and Neutrality Alliance. Pádraic is going to chat to us this morning about the possibility of an EU army and how Ireland should, I suppose, dig its heels in and remain neutral. Pádraic, you're very welcome to the programme this afternoon, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me on and giving me this platform to explain the position regarding the European Army.
Before we discuss the European Army, Pádraic, just something that comes to mind, and I think it was highlighted again with the impending visit of Mr. Trump and the use of Shannon Airport by US service personnel. In the greater scheme of things, how neutral is little neutral Ireland at the moment?
Well, we're not neutral anymore, if the truth be told. Like, officially, we haven't joined NATO, but unofficially, we're providing absolutely basic hub services, hub transportation services, for the US and for NATO. And it's like somebody not being involved in a robbery, but providing the getaway car and the safe house for the cars that are going to be used in that robbery. And the fact that we're actually not doing the bombing, but we're providing the safe haven and we're providing the transportation hub for that to go ahead, means we're equally as involved as actually the country that's doing the bombing. Philosophically, I don't see any difference between those two cases that I've just outlined.
Yeah, in your opinion, we're providing succour to those who are involved in combat.
Well, it's more than succour. You can say, well, we agree with them, or not agree. But like, when you're actually providing, to fly from Texas to Iraq, the Americans don't have enough planes to do that. So what they do is they fly to Shannon. In Shannon, they get refueled. Through Shannon, they bring their personal weapons, the troops. They bring heavy weapons. We have no idea what else they bring through. It's more or less proven beyond doubt that in Bush's era, people were kidnapped and brought through Shannon Airport for what was called extraordinary rendition, which meant kidnap and torture. Of all the planes that have gone through in the last 20 years, not one American plane, military plane, has been searched by the Irish either Gardaí or the aviation police. We're completely complicit. We're providing safe haven and safe transportation hub for the Americans. So it's more than succor. It's aid and succor.
Pádraic, and I'm not coming down on either side of this argument, obviously, because of
you're the other
I am. But what would you say to those that would argue, well, we can't really afford to annoy the Americans because they're a vital part of our economy here in this country, and if we annoy them and poke the bear, there could be repercussions for everybody.
American companies are here. They're not here because we're their ally. They're here because they can make money, because we're a gateway to the European Union, and we have a very favourable tax regime. Like, why, for example, are the Americans... Like, if you look at American foreign investment, there's more American foreign investment in China than there is in Ireland. Like, there are huge American-owned factories or co-owned factories in China, like factories with 10,000-15,000 people involved in them. They're not going to China because China is an ally. China, they're talking about declaring war and all sorts of things on China. Like, they're going to China because they make money, because labour is cheap. They're coming to Ireland because there's a very favourable tax rate. And also then they can get into the EU at zero tax rate. It's money. If they didn't make money in Ireland, the foreign companies wouldn't be here. And we would so it's I know it's argued that one follows the other, but they don't. Profit follows profit, military follows military. It's absolutely basic. If you're a company, are you going to go to someplace that's unprofitable because they're loyal to America, or someone that's profitable and that's actually neutral? If American companies were that fussed about being loyal, they wouldn't have left the Midwest. You know, you wouldn't have a Rust Belt right across the Midwest. You know, they're coming here for money. If that's what they do. That's what it says in the tin. That's what they're supposed to do.
And of course, as things move along, and they have moved along a little bit this morning in Britain, we could very shortly be the only English-speaking country in the EU. So that's something else to bear in mind. Now, Pádraig, yep, let us move along to this horny old chestnut of an EU army. Is it going to be an EU army? Isn't it going to be an EU army? Are we going to be part of it? Are we, again, you know, it's almost like the American scenario in Shannon. Will we be part of it, but we won't be part of it? Or will we be supplying something? You know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
Now, that's one aspect of the question, so I'll double up the question to give you a good run at it. The other side of it is, which I was an argument I heard made by some people recently, that the amount of EU money that this is liable to gobble up is actually horrendous.
Yeah, well, we'll start with the second question first. You know, if the EU army goes ahead, according to the proposals currently in front of the Commission, and the Commission are really driving this, along with the Commission President. But like, if it goes ahead, then each country will be committed to 2% of GDP being spent on defence, and it'll be written in that if you don't spend, it'll be like, you know, your budgetary target. So you have to spend that amount of money. If you don't spend that, there will be EU penalties. Now, to put that in terms which, you know, we can understand, 2%, what does it mean? Well, for example, at the minute, we spend less than 1 billion on defence. We pay our soldiers very badly. But if we increase it to 2%, we will spend 3 billion every year on defence. Now, that's the same as building a children's hospital, fully fitted, every year, ad infinitum. I mean, that's what we're talking about. At a time when our hospitals are falling down, at a time when we've got a huge housing crisis.
Can I just stop you there for 1 second? Is that 3 billion that we have to spend on our own defence forces, or is that 3 billion that we have to contribute into an EU pot?
Basically, it's spent on defence, basically on defence spending, which mostly means equipment, and it means contributing to the European defence. The European Defence Fund and European Defence spending. So it doesn't mean we spend 3 billion on our army and we mean the soldiers actually get paid properly and don't have to rely on a family income supplement. You know, that doesn't mean that spending more money on defence and spending more money paying soldiers properly are two different arguments. You know, they don't go hand in hand at all. You know, it means that we will end up buying, you know, tanks that coincide with what NATO wants. It means we will buy, we'll be contributing to the EU want to build an aircraft carrier. You know, so we'll be paying into an EU aircraft carrier. It means we'll be paying into EU missile defence systems. So it actually isn't anything to do with the ordinary soldier or the ordinary person in the Navy or the person, you know, the having enough pilots in the army, so that we can operate our emergency helicopters. So the two things don't go hand in hand at all. You know, like it means, you know, like it's like spending. Say I'm going to spend X amount of money on say it means you want to buy a bigger car rather than pay your chauffeur properly. You know, so like that's what it means. And that sort of more than a children's hospital every year going down the tubes. That's the first thing about what it will cost, you know, if it comes about. The second thing is, will it come about? Now, in the last 2 years, like, there has been legal provision for a European army, you know, on the build-up to this, but especially for the last 10 years, especially since the Lisbon Treaty was passed, the provision for an EU army and common EU defence policy has been there. So, I mean, the policy has been there for 10 years. I mean, obviously, during the whole EU-wide recession, proposing an EU army wasn't going to go down too well. But in the last few years, and especially with the poor relations at the minute, and especially during Obama's time, between Russia and the US. And now even people are using the fact that Trump is in power. The whole pressure to ratchet has been ratcheted up, the need for a new army. You know, so there has been this political pressure. There has been pressure in particular as well from Chancellor Angela Merkel. She's been pushing the idea no later than last year. Emmanuel Macron, part of his new vision for Europe is a European army. And as I say, the president of the Commission has also pressed it more than once. So the proposals have been pushed, to the Commission, and they're working on that. The Directorate General dealing with defence and security. The other point was is that there's two other things. One is that last year it slipped under the radar quite by and large because of various other things that happened around the same time. But the four outgoing Fine Gael MEPs published a document, make a nice big flashy document as it happens, proposing that Ireland should join NATO. That didn't raise a whole pile of support. So, but it was a serious kite flying effort. We have pressure groups like the Irish Institute for European and International Affairs, making the arguments in the background, making the snowballs for the people to throw, arguing for a European army. It was in the proposal for a European army was in the European People's Party manifesto, the draft. But Fine Gael realised that that would go down in Ireland like a lead balloon, so they sent the junior minister to Brussels to get that removed. So there's a fudge sort of idea in it. But the Fianna Fáil, the group they're aligned with internationally, they actually their European manifesto is in support of the European army. So you can see that there is major support. And the other, just to deal with one thing, because it's just to go up again. The whole thing's being sold is that it's going to be an independent sort of army. It's going to be, it gives Europe independence from Russia, from China, from the USA. But of course, that's actually not true. Because when you look at the details and when you look at what it says in the Lisbon Treaty, the European army and the European the European battle groups and PESCO, they're very clearly set out when you go through the legal setup of them, that they're actually designed to work in cooperation with NATO, that they're actually linked to NATO high command. In other words, they make the idea that this is some way independent and that it would allow Europe to stand up to the United States is actually just untrue. It means that we will be completely locked in to NATO without ever having formally joined NATO, because we'll be part of a body that's subservient to NATO. So like it's the worst of all possible worlds. And it's been pushed through. There was a great phrase coined after Hurricane, the one in New Orleans, where a lot of things changed, a lot of poor people were moved out of important areas. Never let a crisis go to waste. And that's exactly what's happening now. There's supposed to be a crisis of international affairs, and it's been utilised, and the whole pressure has been utilised to create a European army, despite that, as if this is something new, despite the fact that it has actually made constitutional provision for 10 years ago, and the political preparation for it started about the year, just before the Nice Treaty happened in 2000. So the whole planning has been going on for a while in the background, but the actual legal provision was made 10 years ago, and the active planning and political pressure has been ratcheted up in the last 3 years. Now, will we join? I don't know. It's obviously up to the Irish people by and large. But I think we should remember, and I don't know how many Irish people know this, and I don't know how many Irish people understand the implications, but we are already part of PESCO, which is the Permanent European Security Cooperation. And we are also a part of the EU battle groups, you know, which are, you know, very large European battle formations, you know, prepared to NATO standards and prepared to, in cooperation with NATO. So, you know, we already have one boot on of the European army.
Yeah, but Patrick, I could put it to you this way, that, you know, the cynic in me would say, right, let's say we do succeed in getting this EU or European army up and running. Like, who are we going to pick a fight with first? I mean, why do we need them? Now, that's one, that's the cynic in me, but the other side of it in relation to PESCO, which I would probably, on the whole, my argument would be that we should benefit from that because of sharing of intelligence and information, which I think, on the whole, you know, probably the biggest threat to any country is terrorist attacks, the likes of which we have seen in Manchester, in London, and there is no point in thinking that any major city or any country is going to be exempt from one of these happening. So forewarned is forearmed, and being part of this intelligence sharing exercise is a good thing. Now, where I think we come up short, referring to your original point at the very top of our discussion, is that the investment in the defence forces here has been scaled back so far that even if they were in possession of very credible and viable intelligence, the ability to react if something happens could be a question.
Yeah, there are three different things there. One is that PANA has no problem with security cooperation. In other words, if there is a terrorist group operating in one country, and it's likely to move or pick a target in another country, absolutely no problem in that being shared. The issue is that defence and police cooperation are two different sections. So defence cooperation and police cooperation are two different departments, and PESCO hasn't really anything got to do with police and has everything got to do with armies. So that's the first point. The second point
Let's just take a step into the real world for one second.
PESCO's got to do with military cooperation.
Do you seriously think that army intelligence here don't share information with the special branch?
But the point I was going to make after that is that even if there is a security, even if there is an intelligence agency, I'm sure they do. But if that's their operational way of doing it, that's fine. But like, let's say, for example, that some terrorist group look at Shannon Airport and say there's on average 3 transport plane loads of American troops leave Shannon every week, sometimes with as many between them as 2,000 troops. We should bomb that. You know, or do some sort of disruption in it. You know, let's just say that some terrorist group decides that. I have never seen a situation where the purchase of F-16 bombers, or of a submarine, or of an aircraft carrier, or of modern tanks will actually prevent that bombing. What you need is intelligence. You need police on the ground, and you need a very broad education and propaganda profile for that. So the building of an army doesn't defeat terrorism. It's not how you defeat terrorism on a global scale. That's not how you prevent terrorism on a local scale. You know, like F-16s, you know, they're very impressive machines. But if somebody is a lone wolf, or if there's a 3 or a 5-person unit, you know, group going to lay a bomb in Shannon Airport because that's where the planes fly through, or if they're going to blow up some, you know, tower that gives out radar signals, like whatever these people do, you know, having a massive army isn't going to stop that terrorist activity. The second point about the question you asked is who are we going to fight? The question already is like, what are we doing already? If you look, for example, at Operation Sophia in the Mediterranean, again, 2 or 3 years ago when the Irish Navy went to the Mediterranean and the LE, EFA and the LE, whatever else, and they were rescuing and saving thousands of lives, everybody in Ireland, I think, was justly proud of what was happening. But then that operation changed. So our, you know, boat there and all the other European boats that are there now, we're actually not rescuing people and bringing them to Europe. If we rescue people, we're bringing them back to North Africa. We're bringing them back to prison camps in Libya. At the minute, the European Union is actually paying Turkey not to let refugees through. At the present moment, France, for example, has decided and has got help from other European countries that the way to stop refugees, you know, to stop poor people getting from southern Africa to the Sahara up to North Africa, is you stop them just south of the Sahara in the Sahel. So that basically is what we're going to be doing. We're going to be, you know, preventing people moving across North Africa, and we're also going to be doing what we've already been doing covertly, is we're going to be fighting resource wars. You know, about oil, but also, there's only two, I think, places in the world that you can get the vital component for mobile phones. I think if the name is cadmium or something. It's one of these things that always escapes my mind. But the Congo at the minute has the world's sort of stranglehold on it. But apparently some has been found in Syria, some has been found in Afghanistan. So what we're doing with the prospectus that's been set out for the European army is not a defensive army, it's an attack-based army. And it's not a force that's designed to help in aid and relief. It's not one that's going to help in disaster relief. Again, if you want disaster relief, you need big helicopters, you need medvac people, you need all sorts of engineers and nurses and emergency personnel. Fighter bombers are of absolutely no use fighting an earthquake. They're absolutely no use if a tsunami happens. They're no use, you have an avalanche and the side of the mountain comes down and buries some village in the Alps or wherever else. So if we want to have rescue and relief forces internationally, fine with that. But don't build an army and say we're going to do that. I have no problem, and PAN has no problem with international cooperation. We support Ireland being part of the United Nations. We support Ireland being participating in United Nations peacekeeping Chapter 6 missions. We've always supported that. So we're not sort of some people who think that the world is made up of glorified Santa Clauses all going around shouting ho ho ho. We do live in the real world, but more armies breed more wars breed more death and destruction. And I think in Ireland, after 30 years or 40 years, whatever it is now, I think surely we learned enough about death and destruction without bringing in the rest of the world.
Pádraic, there is over this weekend, actually started yesterday, I think, there is something taking place across Europe which we can't discuss because the moratorium kicked in yesterday.
Oh, yes.
But let us say, for the purposes of our chat, and you have 1 minute on this, that the numbers are changed in the EU Parliament as opposed to the way they are right now. Does that change this bill in relation to an EU army?
Obviously, the Commission, in my view, They're not going to pursue something and have it defeated. If you're a senior bureaucrat, whether you're in the county council, whether you're in the Irish Parliament, or whether you're in the EU, you don't want to produce an idea and a plan and have it knocked down. Because it's much more difficult then to bring it forward the second time. So I think what would happen is, with any of the proposals that have hung over between the previous Parliament and the following Parliament, you know, so the people who, the bureaucrats, they're very experienced people. They will look and say, oh, we better drop, we'll move this one quietly over to the pending tray, and we'll move this forward. Because they look around at the political complexion. Like, I think it's impossible to know what will happen, and how the political complexion, what will happen in England, what will happen in Brexit, what will the new situation be like in Germany with the when Merkel leaves in a few months. How stable is Italy? How will the outcome of what's happening this weekend affect Macron's standing? You know, so I think there's a whole pile of unknowables in this, as, and that's the whole beauty of what's of the democratic process. But as I think that the commission at the minute think they're pushing an open door, which they are with certain political leaders. I think if they feel that they can get it through, they'll push it through. If they feel that they're going to meet too much resistance, they'll put it on the back burner and dig it up again when they think they can get it through.
Yeah, well, as we've seen an hour or an hour and a half ago, Páraic, there's a woman across the water found out the hard way, but you can't keep coming back and back with the same thing, dressing it up as something different and trying to get it through. That.
So I think they I think they already know that, so they won't do that. You know, I think we learned in 2005 when the Treaty for the European Union was defeated. You know, if that had been defeated by Ireland, we'd have been had to do it again. It was defeated by France and by Holland at the time, and the Treaty for the European Union, you know, was put to bed slowly, and then 3-4 years later we got the Lisbon Treaty, which didn't need to be go before the people in France, didn't need to go before the people in Holland, because of the way it had been reworded. When we defeated it, we were told, no, lads, get your act together and go and pass it the second time.
Well, now, in fairness, what came up the second time was a totally different proposal to the first one, in fairness, though.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. The Lisbon Treaty didn't change. Like, the Lisbon Treaty is different than the proposed constitution for Europe. So I'm saying, like, they obviously learned their lesson once they've been defeated by France, and they realised, this is a dead duck. Let's not embarrass ourselves anymore, you know. And we'll rescue the bits that's rescuable. We'll put them in again. No, I don't think they were ever going to do Mrs. May on it and try to produce the one treaty wrapped in different colour ribbons 4 times in a row. No. They're a bit more.
Páraic Mannion, Secretary of PANA, which is the Peace and Neutrality Alliance. Páraic, we're way over time, but it has been fascinating, and thank you so much for joining me on today's edition.
I hope you don't get in trouble now with your advertisers or your sponsors or whatever else. Thanks very, very much for this opportunity to discuss this issue.
Well, anybody with complaints, can send them in on the back of a €50 note, please, and we'll take them seriously. Thanks a million, Páraic.
Right, you take care. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Bye.